Welcome to Reach Out in the Darkness. Today's program showcases refugee women from different countries telling their stories. The first event you'll hear took place Monday, March the 4th at the U of L George Howe Barn. It was organized by the Women of United Nations Association, Niara Wakaba, Janet Dake, and Sami Matthew. The first person you'll hear is Marissa Mason of Kentucky Refugee Ministries, referred to throughout this presentation as KRM, or Kentucky Refugee Ministries.
Welcome to the United Nations Association's Women at U of L's Women, Refugee, and Immigrant Monologues. We have a truly incredible series of women from our local community who will be sharing their stories tonight, and we are so grateful that the community could come out to listen, learn, and understand. So before our monologues start, we would like to begin the program by providing everyone with a little background information surrounding this very vast and complex issue of immigration and refugees. So we want to provide everyone with a little background information about the issues of immigration and refugees. So our first speaker is Marissa Mason with the Kentucky Refugee Ministries. Marissa Mason is the Community Engagement and Development Specialist at KRM in Louisville. And she is going to provide us with a little bit of that contextual information. So please join me in welcoming Marissa Mason.
Thank you all so much. And I just want to start by saying thank you to the UNA Women for inviting KRM to be present at this event and for inviting us to speak and give this background. Because as she mentioned, these are very complex issues. And especially in the media these days, it is hard to follow almost everything that's going on and understand the differences. So that's what I'll try and do here to begin, set the stage for these wonderful monologues that you're about to hear. So here's what we will just quickly cover in this 15-minute intro. We'll start with refugees, facts and figures in the world and in the US, and I'll touch a little bit on immigration and other components as well. I'll talk a bit about Kentucky Refugee Ministries, the agency I work for, and what we do in the community for refugees. I'll talk a bit about the impact of refugees in our community, and then just a bit about opportunities to get involved. Please, throughout this, feel free to ask questions, just raise your hand or jump in, because again, this is important information, and we would really love for you to ask questions on anything that you're curious about. So to start off, you know, again, with the words refugee and immigrant floating around the media quite a bit these days, it's important to know the distinctions between these groups. So a refugee is a person forced to flee his or her home country to escape persecution, war, or violence. So the two key components to this definition are he or she was forced to flee, it was not a choice, and he or she crossed the border into a second country. So there are some internally displaced people, IDPs, who had to flee their home city or hometown, but they have not crossed the border into a second country, so they're not technically refugees. Refugees are technically distinct from other migrants who are coming to the US or traveling to other countries for different reasons. And again, immigration these days, it's very blurry, especially in the United States. And so a lot of people are coming to the border in Mexico as asylum seekers. And so by the United Nations definition, they're not technically being classified or registered as refugees, but they are fleeing gang violence and domestic abuse and poverty, extreme poverty. And so they are coming to the United States through a different immigration path, seeking asylum, seeking safety, but just that's just a distinction between those two populations. So in the world currently, there are over 25 million refugees. That's about one third of the larger number of 65.8 million displaced people. And so that includes refugees, and it includes those internally displaced people. This is the worst humanitarian crisis the world has ever seen. It's the worst refugee crisis, but really all around, there are more displaced people in the world than there ever have been before. Over half of that 25 million are minors. They're under the age of 18. There are essentially three options for refugees defined by the United Nations. The first is voluntary repatriation, and that is when the violence ends back home, political stability is restored, and they are able to go back to their home country. Given the conflicts nowadays, that is not looking like a feasible solution in the near future. So a second option is integration, and that is within the secondary country to which that refugee fled. These are some of the top hosting countries at the moment, taken from the UN's website. Turkey taking on the overwhelming majority, 3.5 million, Uganda, Pakistan, Lebanon, Iran. Of course, these numbers have a lot to do with proximity to conflict. So refugees will flee to these nations, and they can try to integrate into the city. Adults can try to find a job, working under the table, attempt to get their kids in school. But still there are challenges, as refugees do not have legal rights in those countries. They may not be very welcoming communities, and so integration has its own obstacles there. A third option is resettlement, and that's the program we have in the United States. It's where a refugee can apply for and be selected to come to a third country, where they will receive legal rights, benefits, and services from the government. Sadly, only a handful of countries in the world have such an established program. The United States is one of them, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and a few European countries. But less than 1% of refugees in the world are resettled through that program. This is a schematic of the refugee experience, and we talked about that top half. Starts with the violence or persecution at home, causing families to flee to a secondary country where they could try to integrate into the city, or they could be residing in a refugee camp. From there, from that secondary country, they apply to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the UNHCR. That is essentially where they register as refugees. It's how they can get into a refugee camp. And it is the first step in this very lengthy application process for resettlement. That process through the UN and through the US takes a minimum of 2 years, but it often takes a lot longer, many years. Numerous levels of background checks, security clearances, medical screenings. Representatives from the US government are overseas conducting in-person interviews. So it's really an incredibly vigorous vetting process, but if a family does make it through and they are selected to come, their information is passed through the State Department to a national resettlement agency, who then decides where they'll be resettled within the U.S. If they are sent to Kentucky, Louisville, or Lexington, that's where our organization, KRM, or also in Louisville Catholic Charities, will resettle them locally. So that's kind of where we come in. We're not a part of this process, but we help families get settled here and make a home in Kentucky. Actually, let me go back and let's pause. Does anybody have questions on that process? Yes. Yeah, so she's asking about kind of the total number of people who even apply for resettlement. And the shorter answer is no, I do not have that number. But I know that you need to be selected as a candidate to even be able to apply. And that initial screening is done through the United Nations, and the flagging as a potential candidate is really based on, it's really the most vulnerable populations, which is hard to even define when you're looking at refugees as a whole. But for example, victims of violence and torture, unaccompanied minors, mothers that are single moms with large families, those are some of the folks that will be potentially flagged, or special medical cases. Yeah, but I don't know the percentage of that group that apply that actually do get selected. Yeah, so she was asking about this lengthy application process. Why does it take so long? It can take up to 10 years. And so there are, as I mentioned, those numerous levels of clearances. I believe the number is either 32 or 36 different clearances that you need in terms of medical security and background checks. Once you get a clearance, each different clearance has different expiration dates. They all cost money. If you miss one and you have to go back later for another, others can expire during that time period. And so it's really this incredibly unfortunate cycle of you needing to get all of these, and a lot of it in the interviews, a lot can, you know, slip through the cracks. If you happen to be sick the day of your medical screening, that's very unfortunate. You're going to probably have to reschedule and other clearances might expire. So again, it is a very tough vetting process through that. So great question. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, so it is a federal program run through the State Department, and I believe it's 48 states that accept refugees. It might be 45. So this is just a look at the U.S. refugee admissions numbers from the past few years. We operate on a fiscal year calendar, same as the federal government. And again, you look at these numbers in comparison to 25 million, and it is a drop in the bucket. But I will say it is the executive branch's decision how many refugees we welcome each year. And so President Obama had set the bars at 85 and 110,000 when he was in office. That number was lowered in fiscal year 2017 by President Trump to 50,000. Last year, it was 45,000 when we, in actuality, with all of the different executive orders, resettled less than half of that. And we're hoping this year to resettle to 30,000, the lowest bar ever set by any president. So KRM, just a bit about who we are. And Catholic Charities, I will say, we are both doing the same work here in Louisville. We really offer resettlement and integration services for refugees. We have been around for 28 years, resettled over 16,000 refugees from over 50 different nationalities. Here are some of the countries of origin of our clients. So we resettle from all over the world, regardless of race, religion, politics. We are blind to that. We're primarily receiving what we refer to as clients. Anyone we serve is our clients. Through the U.S. Refugee Program, which we just discussed, another program called the Special Immigrant Visa Program, which is folks who work for the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan, come through that program. And then it's cut off a bit, but a Cuban entrant program. So we serve a lot of Cubans, and they just fall under a separate immigration status. So to try and give you a quick summary of what we do, it's easiest to think of our services in three tiers. Our basic needs, self-sufficiency, and integration. For basic needs, we are finding these folks housing before they get to the United States. We pick them up at the airport the night that they arrive, and on a fairly strict timeline, we're getting their documents and IDs straightened out. We get them a social security number, help them apply for temporary food, cash, and medical programs, get their kids registered in school, and get them connected with a refugee health screening. With our self-sufficiency services, of course, they're really targeted at empowering people to become self-sufficient. And so we have English classes, medical and mental health services, a thriving employment services. And actually, I will take this moment to shout out Morgan at the KRM table in the back. She is our women's employment specialist. And so we have been fortunate to grow our employment to now include women specialty, so even women who have been here a few years can come back and reconnect with our job developers. And finally, our integration services, we really see that as the next step beyond self-sufficiency. So we have our immigration services. We're proud to say we have 5 full-time immigration attorneys on staff. They are serving our clients and also any immigrants in the wider community. We have an elder program, arts programming, a media lab, and so we really cover a lot of services, and we do everything we possibly can to make these families really find their home here in Kentucky and thrive here. The employment, the economic impact of refugees in our community is substantial. We have over 200 unique employees employing our clients. They're coming to us to hire our clients. Our retention rates are high, and our clients, our refugee clients, want to work. And I would say the same immigrant clients as well. It's people want to give back to this community and they want to find a home here. And then of course our youth and adults who are pursuing higher education degrees, we have college and career readiness programs for them. And so they are doing incredible things. And it is, a lot of times it is that second generation who's really integrating into American culture and really finding their ground and getting an education and coming to U of L. And so it's wonderful, their growth. Just opportunities to get involved. And I will say this really applies beyond just KRM, Kentucky Refugee Ministries. All of the organizations that are at this event tonight serve immigrants and refugees in the community. They're doing incredible work, and their staff members are just the most amazing people, and they are doing the on the ground really tough work. And so supporting them in any way that you can means the world to us. And so you can stay in the loop, just get connected with us via our social media, our website, our e-newsletters, volunteer. I know KRM, and I'm sure all the other organizations, have outstanding opportunities for you to do direct service work, like mentorship, classroom assistance, our Football Friends program. I always want to shout out, we need people to transport our youth to soccer games, and then of course to give. And that makes such an impact to us too. It means that you are putting your money where your values are, and you're saying that you support the work that we do. And so that could come from hosting a benefit or a fundraiser. It could be as small but as meaningful as just setting up our organization or another organization you're passionate about as your charity of choice with Amazon and Kroger. Every time you shop there, they give a little bit to us. Those are various ways that you can get involved. And finally, of course, just sharing the facts. The fact that you are here this evening is so significant. It says that you care about these issues and that you want to listen, you want to learn, and that you will stay informed. This is your way of staying informed. You know, right now I keep referencing, it's so hard to find facts. And so coming to events like these, that's how you find them. And that's how you learn. And so thank you so much for being here. Thank you for having us here. And I am so excited to learn from these wonderful women and hear their stories, because we have a lot to learn from them this evening. So thank you very much.
Hi everyone, thank you so much for coming out today. My name is Niara Wakaba, and I serve as president of UNA Women at U of L. First, I want to take the time to say thank you so much to Marissa Mason from KRM for giving us some background information on such an important issue. And now I would like to introduce our first speaker, Adama Kamara. Adama moved to America as a child from her home country of Sierra Leone in West Africa. She plans on transferring to the University of Louisville this fall. In her free time, she enjoys volunteering in the Louisville community at organizations such as Americana Community Center. Please join me in welcoming Adama Kamara to the stage.
The amputation of limbs, butchering women to confirm the sex of the child, raping women in front of their relatives, using women as sex slaves. These are the reasons why there are refugees from Sierra Leone. This evening, I'm going to discuss the effects of war, my story, struggles, joys, and refugee women. First, let me tell you the effects of war. During a war, you struggle with hunger. Finding food for yourself and for others becomes a problem. I experienced this problem during the Sierra Leone Civil War. During the Sierra Leone Civil War, children as young as 10 years old were forced to fight in a war that they didn't understand. Rebel leaders would force children to kill their parents so they could be ruthless child soldiers. There was a time when my brother Lamine and his friends were in a truck, and they were coming from the villages to Freetown, where it was safer. Soon along the way, they were stopped by rebels. Soon after, the rebels shot all the men in the truck, including my brother Lamine. Then they set the truck on fire. There was no burial. They left the burned bodies there. Injustice was done to everyone. My story begins when I was 4 years old, living with my mother and father, and Sierra Leone was in chaos. One day, three men came to my parents' home and asked if they could take me to the Child Survival Center. Initially, my parents said no, but after a few times, my parents allowed them to take me to the Child Survival Center. Soon, the rebels were coming into the city where the Child Survivor Center was. My dad tried to get me back into his custody, but he was not able to because the three men that came to my father's home said no. In order for my dad to survive, he had to immediately leave. I was stolen from my mother and father. Quickly, the three men took many children and me by foot to Guinea. There was a refugee camp in Guinea. From the refugee camp, I was adopted out of the refugee camp and came to the United States. Nobody told my family where I went. They believed I was dead. My reaction to how I was adopted is sadness and survivor's guilt. I feel sad because I was ripped apart from my family. And I have survivor's guilt as an adult because I was the only one that was adopted out of the United States. I still have family in Sierra Leone, and they suffer a lot. I know this because I went to Sierra Leone to visit them when I was 16. I'm not the only one that struggles. Other refugee women struggle too. Whether you're wearing a hijab, have an accent, skin color, clothing, judgment of appearances, it's a struggle that refugee women go through every day. Even today, people ask me, where do you come from? What country are you from? That's because I look different. My name is often mispronounced and may result in discrimination on resumes. It is very easy for a refugee woman to lose her culture and identity and tradition once she has assimilated into the United States. Then you wonder, what identity am I? When I reunited with my Sierra Leonean family, I learned that they identified me as a Sierra Leonean. However, I'm an American citizen. I grew up in America. I know its cultures and traditions. So as a 24-year-old, I'm still trying to identify myself. Do I have to choose? Am I abandoning my families if I do? Even though there are some hardships, there are also joys in life as a refugee. I had a teacher that stayed after school with me for a couple hours for years to teach me how to speak, read, and write in English. And she did that so I could fit in and be successful in school. And also, I've helped other refugees and women and children through organizations such as Kentucky Refugee Ministries and Americana World Community Center. It is very fulfilling to know that you're helping someone who once was in your shoes. This evening, I have discussed the effects of war, my story, struggles, joys, and refugee women. Fortunately or unfortunately, refugees will always be here with us. Fortunately is because we give them light, we give them hope, we give them guidance so they can live their best lives. We need refugees. They enrich our country. Unfortunately is because refugees have to flee their native country and come to a country that discriminates, has sexual harassment, and gender inequality. Horrific images and stories might always be in a refugee woman's memory from the war or crisis that she has faced in her native country. And I know that. But with organizations such as I mentioned, and people like you who could be a mentor or help, refugee women could be their best selves. They can be their best selves. And they also can live a better life than they did before. It is great when a refugee woman learns to love herself, gains confidence despite the obstacles that she has overcome, and continues to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Adama, for that beautiful story that you shared with us. Now I'd like to welcome our next guest to the stage, Muna Ibrahim, who is a dear friend of mine. She is 23 years old, born in Somalia, and moved here in 2010. She recently graduated with her Associates in Arts from Simmons College of Kentucky. In her free time, she enjoys spending time with family and reading books. Please, let's welcome Muna Ibrahim.
Hi, my name is Muna, and I thank you for having me today. I was born in Somalia in a city called Medina. I grew up in a single parent home where my mom had to support myself and my older two brothers, since my father was not in our lives anymore. And he died right before I was born, but we had to leave Somalia because of the after effect of the war. In 2005, we moved to Nairobi, Kenya, in search for more opportunities such as reliable education, housing, and safety. Here, my mom was able to send me and my brothers to school. After living in Nairobi for about 5 years, we tried to apply for Kenya's citizenship, but it was really hard. Eventually, we heard about the UNHCR, which stands for United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees. Through this organization, we began the process of applying for asylum in a third country resettlement. We did not get to choose which country we were going to, and we did not know how long it would take. The process ended up taking nearly 4 years, but right before we got approved, we ended up being homeless because my mom could no longer work and take care of us. We had to sleep outside the building of UNHCR. There were several other families sleeping outside there too, families with children and elderly people. One day we got a phone call from a case manager who asked my mom to come in for an appointment. Later on that day, my mom came back with a UNHCR bag full of documents, and she told us we were moving to the United States. Because we were homeless, they placed us on a temporary housing with other families who were soon being resettled in other countries. We arrived in the U.S. in June of 2010, and it felt like the hottest day on earth. I know that it might sound crazy because I was coming from a continent that was considered to be one of the hottest, but but American heat felt like it was an oven because of the humidity. We were resettled in Louisville with the assistance of Catholic Charities. They provided us housing, clothes, enrolled us in school. We had to adapt, which was really challenging. In April 2012, my mother passed away from cancer. We were devastated, but God helped us get us through it all. I am now a graduate of Simmons College of Kentucky, and my brother has a successful career, and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for sharing that story with us, Muna. So our next speaker of the evening is Noreen Hamo, and she is a proud Louisville resident who has been in the United States for 3 years with her 4 sons. She escaped from the war in Syria and lived in Turkey for 2 years before getting approval to move to the United States. She is currently a student at JCTC, and in her free time, she enjoys cooking as well as spending time with her children and friends. Please welcome Noreen to the stage.
Hello, everyone. I am so honored to be invited by the United Nations Association, Women of UL, to share my story. I am Noreen Hamo from Aleppo, Syria. Please be patient with me. I am still learning English. I was very happy in Syria with my family, my husband and 4 sons. I did not think one day I would leave my home. The first morning to a scared holiday, my husband, Sido, went to the bakery to buy the family's daily bread and never come home. Late the afternoon, my older sister and brothers-in-law found me and told me he had been shot in the leg. I rushed in a taxi to my father's home, and my younger sister was crying. She told me my husband had passed away. I ran on blood to where he was. When I finally saw him, the right side of his face was ripped open, and there was 3 bolt holes in his chest. Sido was with God now, with God, and I was in shock. 2 months later, my older son, Ahmed, who was 6, threw up and peeing blood. He was Dyke's son with leukemia, but there was no treatment and well, torn Syria. I had to get him to Turkey with government, with only person, one sick person, to cross the border. Thankfully, my parents cared of my other sons. During chemotherapy, I went to Turkey without knowing the English language. After that, my person came to Turkey to help me to accept the world. All my brothers and my sister live in the what and went to Turkey also. I still in Turkey from 2 years and learning Turkish at the hospital while caring for my son. My son suffered a lot. He had chemotherapy for 4 years. I am so happy, proud he is cancer free. I came to the United States with the help of the United Nations. I was so scared. I know no English and no family here. My sponsor is KRM. I have been with them for 3 years. They helped me a lot, so much. Please welcome my son. I get my driver license and I am learning English at JCTC now. I hope to have a good life for my child. I am so grateful to everyone who helped me every steps for the way. During my times of great need, I appreciate the compassion that saved my son's life, and I think my story helps the compassion grow. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Noreen, for sharing your story. And thank you to all of our speakers who have shared their story this far.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to WFMP 106.5 FM. And this is Ruth Newman, your host of Reach Out in the Darkness, with a series of presentations given on Monday, March 4th at the U of L George Howe Barn. We just now finished listening to Narim Hamo, a refugee from Syria, who escaped with her four sons to the U.S. The next speaker, Niara Wakaba, will read Mariana Juarez's story.
Mariana Juarez was born and raised in Mexico City, Mexico. She moved to Simpsonville, Kentucky with her parents and siblings in August of 2014 at the age of 18. Currently, she is a senior finance and economics major here at the University of Louisville and an intern at Access Ventures. In her free time, she loves to run, read, and watch movies. Here's her monologue. My name is Mariana Juarez. I am 22 years old, and in August, it will be 5 years since I moved to the US. I was born and raised in Mexico City, one of the largest cities in the world, alongside five siblings. I attended an all-girls school for 10 years. I grew up with the same friends, went to the same mall every Friday, rode the same bus, went to the same supermarket, and to the same church my whole life. My life was a routine. It was predictable, it was comfortable, and I was the happiest person on the planet. I never planned to move to the US, to trade my life and everything I had in Mexico for something completely different. I had everything planned, my whole life. Where I would go to college, where I would live, where I would work. I had my whole life in Mexico planned. It was predictable, it was comfortable, and it was familiar. Early in 2014, things changed. My dad gained his US citizenship, and with that, I gained my permanent residency. This was not part of the plan, but I suddenly realized it was an opportunity. An opportunity for a better life and for better options. I came to Kentucky with my parents and siblings in August of 2014. I was lucky. I came here with my entire family. My dad had already bought a beautiful house and we were enrolled in a school that was brand new. I was very lucky. I applied for colleges and ended up going to U of L because they offered me the most money. Being here completely changed my life. Growing up with the same group of people, I was never aware of what was out there. I had never been around so many people with different ways of thinking. I had been trapped and I didn't know it. Coming to the US gave me freedom. It gave me a world of opportunities. I traded comfort for challenge without knowing, and for that, I am grateful.
Our next story is from a woman named Maria Zaman Khan, who could not be here today due to a family emergency. Maria is originally from Pakistan, where she lived with her mom and siblings in Islamabad. Her father left to America when she was a child, and the rest of her family joined him in Louisville years later. She is currently a freshman at the University of Louisville and is the co-author of No Single Sparrow Makes a Summer, along with her sister Maywish. This is her story. About 2 years ago, after arriving in the US, there was a time when I felt nervous, confused, and like I just didn't belong. It was at an airport on a school trip to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. I was wearing a yellow summer shirt with jeans and a hijab. All around me, people were gathering their luggage. My teacher told me, Maywish, and one other student who was Muslim not to say Allah anywhere in the airport. We got our tickets, then one of the security guards stared at Maywish and I with suspicion and doubt. He asked us for our IDs and passports, and two more security guards, both women, came from far off and stopped us in the middle of other people. They took us into a small white room. They told us to sit down. They told us they were given permission to search us because we were wearing hijabs, and they touched the outside of our hijabs. They even made us take our hijabs off. Then they touched our hair, telling us that they had to do this to make sure we weren't hiding anything in our hair. I felt so disappointed. After this, they asked to see our documents. I got more and more uncomfortable. They stopped us for an hour. All of my friends and my teacher were waiting for us. I felt like we shouldn't be there, but I also knew they were following orders from above. I felt so depressed because of the way we were treated differently from others. They judged us because of what we were wearing and what we believed in.
Our final speaker of the evening is Yaz Martinez Torres. Yaz is a local independent photographer and visual creator. She leaped into the creative world as a hobby with her older sister and has been serving the Latino community ever since. If she isn't working, you will find Yaz with a pen in hand and a journal, listening to a favorite podcast. She's a lover of words and storytelling, especially those that take her back to her roots in Jalisco, Mexico. Please join me in welcoming Yaz to the stage.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me. In order to move forward, I think that it is essential for me to talk about my past. My story surrounding borders started years before I was born. It began with my maternal grandfather, my paternal grandfather, my father, whom all traveled into the U.S. for temporarily to work. It started years later when my dad met my mom, married her, and then temporarily relocated to Chicago to work and save for our home in Mexico. In the middle that is being newlyweds and being in their mid-20s, they started a small family and two baby girls. Being from the Midwest of Mexico, Chicago may not have been ideal, so they moved back to their warm home in rural Jalisco, Mexico. Fast forward a few years later, they were a unit of six. Them, four baby girls, and their future. That's how it all started. I was born and raised in Mexico until I was seven. The memories from the small town are hazy, but the people dearest to me, I hold fresh in my memory. I get flashes now and then of what it was to reside there once. It arises through difficult situations, such as my grandfather's death, or random experiences like smelling a bar of soap. That's how memories work sometimes. We were relocated in Louisville by November 2002. This was crucial because I was homesick and I cried for half of my school year, which was half of an actual school year. It was brutal, and I'm assuming it was brutal for my teachers too. What it now seems like a blink of an eye, I walked away knowing English at the end of that same school year. Something I once yearned alongside my younger sister, Alma. And so one of the first memories in the US is carelessly acting to speak English with her, like it would slip through our tongues effortlessly, which was not the case, but it was our dream. I was privileged to be raised by an educator and an engineer who pushed my sisters to thrive in academic efforts. The message growing up was that we could be whatever we wanted because America was a place that you could thrive if you really wanted to. They worked year round, taking one or two days off per week, including summers. That's when my sisters and I had plenty of time to explore creatively, that being surfing through the internet without being scolded for going past our computer curfew. And so I watched my older sister Jessica play around on an off-brand Photoshop, and she dive into making blended photo collages of celebrities and making GIFs. After that, we spent almost every weekend and every summer entering competitions on Univision's The Spanish Network. They have a website. And we would go on their forums, their creative forums, and we would enter competitions. After that, we created our own HTML-based blogs. Jessica's blog was called Con Amor, which means with love. And like a loyal sister, mine was called Con Amor too. These experiences shaped the way that I began to see the world. And in seventh grade, I won my first journalism award. I started paying more attention to
the Univision channel with Jorge Ramos and Maria Elena Salinas, who became an inspiration in the journalism field for their knowledge and their unique angle on the coverage of the world and national events. Seventh grade was also the year I begged my dad for a point and shoot, which he was reluctant to buy for me, but he did, launching me into the world of photography and photojournalism. High school comes around, and amid every anxiety and fears seem to be catching on to me. And so my act of self-discovery took flight. Throughout my high school journalism career, I covered immigration-related issues and used my background in hopes to frame these issues in a more inclusive way or worldview. Winning Journalist of the Year for Kentucky and some other creative awards during my senior of high school. It seemed that it was a tug and pull between my anxieties and my excitement with the world. Meanwhile, my legibility as a deferred action for childhood arrivals recipient was still very fresh as it was announced in 2012. This was an executive action that gave me a little bit of hope for my future than just a blurry path. I continue to be grateful to this day for this opportunity that arose through the Obama administration. Today, though, it's especially hard not to remind myself that the immigration system is distorted, with about 2.5 million undocumented immigrants deported between 2009 and 2015. A lost promise of an immigration reform and a current border crisis. On 45's Inauguration Day, it became clear how unclear the future was in regards to immigration, and that my status as only temporary was in the power of the president. So here I am, over 10 years later, after taking and editing my first photo, and I am still gravitationally pulled into visual creation. I'm inspired by the intricacies of the world around me and in awe of the beauty that can reside in the day-to-day despite the emotional and political state. I continue to serve Latin families across Louisville by capturing their events, pointing out to mostly myself that after all, I might just be where I should be, fulfilling part of my childhood dream and creating visual poems. And that's what I do here, falling in love with the complicated, painful, but ultimately amazingly beautiful life, reminding myself that I am part of my ancestors' story as much as I am of theirs. Life exists beyond borders. Thank you.
Thank you to my friend Yaz for sharing her inspiring story. We'd like to thank and show gratitude to all of our speakers tonight for courageously sharing their stories with the community about their experiences being a woman refugee or immigrant. We also would like to thank everyone who offered their support to help UNA Women at U of L put on this event. The U of L Women's Center, the United Nations Association Kentucky Division, the Kentucky Refugee Ministries, the Common Table of Catholic Charities, Heine Brothers Coffee, George Howe, and all of the vendors for the information they have provided us. Finally, we thank all of you for coming tonight. Most importantly, we hope you are inspired to take action within our community. There are several local organizations that serve the refugee and immigrant residents. The Iroquois Library holds English conversation clubs every Saturday from 3 to 5 p.m. Kentucky Refugee Ministries has a multitude of programs and is actively seeking volunteers. Americana World Community Center also does great work with our international community and could use more hands on deck. La Casita works for the Hispanic population in Louisville and could always use donations and volunteers. These are just a few local organizations to get involved with. Additionally, House Bill 240 is currently being discussed in the Kentucky State Legislature, which would force local law enforcement to prioritize immigration enforcement over other duties and would prevent universities from being able to admit or employ undocumented people. In response to this, we encourage you to contact your legislators
and express your concerns for this bill in support of the immigrant and refugee population.
Just a reminder to all of our listeners that WFMP does not make political endorsements and that the views expressed are those of the speaker, not of the station.
And with that, we conclude our program for this evening. Thank you for coming and have a good night.
What you'll hear next is a woman I met at the dog park who fled Venezuela in 2015. So here is her story. I'm here with Kayla Penezola and her daughter, Lane Grillo. They're from Venezuela. They've been here since 2015. Tell me a little bit about life in Venezuela, what you were doing there and what your situation was.
Okay, well, hi. My name is Kayla. Everybody know me, Kiki. Well, I am living in Venezuela for 42 years. And the time when I growing was really nice. I can find basic stuff, food, everything. But when I started, the government, Chavez, Maduro, our life began to be really, really sad and danger, unstable.
And what was some of the first things that you noticed that were happening to you that you didn't like?
When I start to see the message for the President Chavez in that moment was really aggressive to the people. And that changed the mind to many people in there, mostly the people with most necessity. That people find to Chavez like a god. I mean, this guy will be fix all our problem. And Chavez start to give food and say, I will build this house for everyone. I will give you food for free. And you don't have any problem anymore. Keep pretending like everyone have the same right. Like, if I work so hard to build my company, the guy don't doing nothing, he have the same right like me, and he just can't take my company because he just want. Because Chavez say everyone have the same right. Mm-hmm. So Chavez, he take the farms, was a disaster. And all the companies in there was in control of the government. I, citizen in my country, because I am not political in there. I say, oh my gosh, that's coming really hard. I think the future of Venezuela not looks pretty. And I noticed the worst problem was in the hospital. In that moment was really heavy, heavy. The hospital in bad condition because my father-in-law was in there in one hospital and was really poor quality. Mm-hmm. In the hospital, in the condition, in the moment, every patient need to come bring all the basic. If he need all the insulins, mm-hmm, for, yeah, the patient, the family need to bring because the hospital don't have nothing. The quality of the doctor was really good. The human is good.
And this was during the Chavez government?
Yeah. It's starting to think that when I studied and I worked so hard to get something, mm-hmm, buy my car or buy my house, mm-hmm, this guy just coming and, okay, I can take your house because Chavez say I can. That is absolutely not right, because it's like coming anyone and, oh, how many rooms do you have free? Three? Okay, come, this family come to live with you because you, mm-hmm, you have three bedrooms.
But yet, he was so popular. Didn't they elect him three times?
Well, yes, the last one was really close, but the people want change. But the thing is, Chavez got sick, and he say, if something happened to me, you need to elect Maduro to president. And he just go to Cuba and he disappeared for his treatment. According with our constitution, if the president is not there, the president of our Congress need to be in charge. And that not happen. In December, it's too many news about if Chavez die or not die. Nobody know about Chavez. Starting with when Chavez say, something happened to me, you need to choose Maduro. That was 2013. Yeah.
And how did this affect you?
Well, economical, really hard. I participate in Voluntad Popular. They are a political party. Is a political party of opposition. The leader is Leopoldo López. He is in jail because he wants a better Venezuela for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I talk anyhow to say, hey, this is Voluntad Popular. We need to talk about the constitution. The next candidate was Enrique Capriles. And we're talking about, hey, he have a plan. He have a new choice for Venezuela. And
so it was López, is that was his name, López?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so what was it you liked about him? What did he propose for Venezuela that?
The leadership of López coming because he was our governor in our neighbor. So we know how he worked. I live in Chacao. It's a place, Chacao.
Is it a district or
City?
Or?
Yeah, it's like Jefferson Town. The environment was really better, no trash in the street. We have policemen. All the law, everyone follow the rules. Everyone like to live in that part because, mm-hmm, I mean, everything is pretty and everything is legal. And we see López in our house, like, hey, talk the door, how's everything? You need to pour something for the town. You need to fix something. Or what do you want to be better, our community? He include all the people.
Right.
The health service in that part, everyone want to come to that part of our city. You have place to work and safely, really, really safely. Not right now. Right now, you can work in my country in any part. The government start to give you ID, but you need to be a part of the political party of them.
Oh.
To buy the food.
So then what did that do to you?
Well, for me, I resist.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to buy food in that big line, because they usually sell the food in like a truck, the people do a big line to buy one chicken. But to buy this, you need to be part of this political party, PSUV. It's a political party of the government.
Mm-hmm.
But my only ID, Venezuelan, this is my only ID I need. In the constitution, no say you need to be part of any political party to buy food.
Mm-hmm.
And any part of the constitution say that. These people push me and they hurt me. Actually, I remember recently with a surgery. They have milk and I need to buy milk because I have a daughter, I have a nephew, and I went because it's one milk per person. And okay, I will buy a milk. And the people push me and throw on the floor and they, hey, I have a surgery.
And that's because you were not in the right political party?
Yeah.
Well, it looks like we've run out of time. Thank you so much for listening to Reach Out in the Darkness. Bye for now.